comedy nerds will be mad that I didn't include alternative comedy stuff. This list also doesn't include stand-up, because that would be its own can of excellent worms, starring the likes of Louis C.K., Wanda Sykes, Monique, Jerry Seinfeld, etc. I know that there are probably glaring omissions. Come on, guys. I'm not a professional list maker. Just be cool. Number 1. Will Ferrell shouting from the phone booth in Anchorman. Anchorman is a strange little miracle of a movie, with some historic comedy film significance too. It put together an all-star team of comedy actors that includes Will Ferrell, Paul Rudd, Steve Carell, and Dave Koechner. No other pairings of these guys would ever be as funny as this. I'm sure I'll go see and really love Uncle Retreat or whatever movie comes out next, but it won't make my mouth drop like Anchorman did. When Ron Burgundy, amazing names in this movie, by the way, believes his dog has been killed by an angry motorist, Jack Black, used perfectly, he is so overcome with grief he can't do the news that night. He calls from a phone booth, in one of the funniest, most theatrical displays of grief I have ever seen. It's like grief with a capital G. There's a heightened style of acting that Will Ferrell and Adam McKay employ in their movies that is incredibly difficult to pull off. If done poorly, heightened comedy acting can seem like you're watching an inadvertently campy kids production of 12 Angry Men, but it is Will Ferrell's sweet spot. He has made a career of making unlikely things not only totally work, but also be the funniest things I've ever seen. I'm of course referring to the movie Elf, whose premise reads like the ramblings of an insane little kid drunk off Christmas eggnog. Number 2. Liz Lemon crying out of her mouth on 30 Rock. Here's what the episode is about. Alec Baldwin's Jack Donaghy convinced Tina Fey's Liz Lemon to get eye surgery so she'll be more TV-friendly for her new talk show. Unfortunately, and fortunately for us, the surgery makes her cry out of her mouth. I believe this joke is a perfect joke. Funny in theory and in thinking, and even funnier in execution. Plus, it is hilariously visual. I'm jealous of whoever wrote this. Number 3. Chris Farley as Matt Foley. The best parts of the great book Live from New York by Tom Shales are when performers like Chris Rock, David Spade, and Adam Sandler talk about Chris Farley. They speak of their friend in the most reverential ways. Chris Rock says that when anyone ever asked him who was the funniest of the group there, it was always, always Chris Farley. I totally get it. Matt Foley, the motivational speaker, is probably my favorite recurring Saturday Night Live character ever. The level of commitment from Chris Farley is astounding, almost disturbing. The famous one, when he picks up David Spade like King Kong, and then later falls and smashes a coffee table, is one of the most deliriously funny things I've ever seen in my life. Number 4. Amy Poehler as Caitlin. In just the past 10 years or so, Amy Poehler has produced a lifetime's worth of awe-inspiring performances. Her hyperactive 11-year-old Caitlin is my favorite. There's an innocence to the performance that is such a surprise. Caitlin's adventures with her subdued, kind, put-upon stepdad, Rick, played with the perfect amount of listlessness by Horatio Sanz, make me laugh, but also make me want to take care of Caitlin. One of my greatest pet peeves is women who infantilize themselves in real life, but I have a special place in my heart for women who can play little girls convincingly. Amy, all woman, all awesome, kicks ass as a little girl. Number 5. The racial draft on The Chappelle Show. If you watch this sketch, you can't believe it actually aired on television. The sketch portrayed all the races as professional teams, picking celebrities from a draft pool of all races to form the strongest race. Chappelle Show did consistently edgy sketches that pushed the envelope with political and racial comedy, but was so funny that it never got in trouble. So much can be excused if you're just funny enough. Sarah Silverman has this rare gift. If I even inch towards making a race joke, it's so artlessly done, someone immediately wants me removed from set. Number 6. Paul Rudd in Wet Hot American Summer. Paul Rudd plays the funniest dick boyfriend of all time. The scene in this movie in which he refuses to pick up a tray is the moment when Paul Rudd transformed in my eyes from handsome straight guy in a comedy movie to weirdo generator of awesome comedy in a handsome guy's body. His past performances as nice guy in Clueless and Romeo and Juliet make this turn especially delicious. Number 7. Ricky Gervais as David Brent. Only people who have seen the British Office will remember the moment when David Brent says, "I think there's been a rape up there," in a sensitivity training seminar he is holding. As my friend BJ Novak described it, it was such a profoundly funny moment on television that there was a paradigm shift in comedy after he said it. With the character of David Brent, Ricky Gervais guaranteed that he would live in the pantheon forever, even if he did years of terrible, mediocre stuff. I'm not saying he will, but he could if he wanted. He's like Woody Allen, and the original The Office is his Annie Hall. Number 8. Christopher Moltisanti's drug intervention on The Sopranos. The Sopranos was one of the funniest shows ever, with a level of observational comedy that most comedies would kill for. This is the only drug intervention I have ever seen that ends in the person being helped getting beaten up by his loved ones. Number 9. Frank the Tank getting shot in the neck with a tranquilizer in Old School. Sorry so much, Will Ferrell. I just love this guy so much. This series of moments is a masterpiece of editing and excellent blocking choices by Todd Phillips. Here's the sequence. Frank the Tank gets hit in the neck with an animal tranquilizer meant for a petting zoo animal. Groggy and heavily drugged, he meanders around a yard, knocking over a child's elaborate birthday cake, of course. He then immediately falls into the pool. And while he's underwater, the movie is scored to the somber and dulcet Simon and Garfunkel's Sounds of Silence in homage to The Graduate. It's just a dense brownie of sweet physical comedy. 9B. Will Ferrell getting shot in the neck is tied with Will Ferrell stabbing his own thigh with a knife to prove he is paralyzed in Talladega Nights. Number 10. Melissa McCarthy in Bridesmaids. Sometimes you watch something so funny, you realize after the moment is over that you've stopped breathing. You're actually breathless. That's how I felt the first time I saw Melissa McCarthy in Bridesmaids, in the scene when she first meets Kristen Wiig's character and tells her she hasn't been doing so well because she fell off a cruise ship and then hit every rail down, and finally has several metal pins in her leg from the experience. You don't often hear the words captivating and gross used to describe the same character in a movie, but Melissa McCarthy managed to evoke both in the very best ways. I could not keep my eyes off of her. Number 11. Michael Scott hitting Meredith with his car on The Office. In the history of The Office, I believe the single funniest moment is when Michael Scott hits Meredith Palmer with his car, just as he's talking about how much he loves his employees. Our show may have a great writing staff, and we might have written some fantastic jokes, and I think our cast is amazingly funny. But when Michael screams as Meredith hits his front windshield, and we cut to the opening credits music, I just don't think anything is as purely funny as that. I think tribesmen in a remote jungle in the Congo, they would find that moment funny. Some others. Borat, on the treadmill in Da Ali G Show, A Star is Born. Michael Palin's massive stutter attack in A Fish Called Wanda, a tour de force, everyone doing exactly what they do best at the same time. Dwight Schrute capturing a bat in a trash bag around Meredith Palmer's head on The Office, a moment of tiny, hilarious violence. Kristen Wiig's Bjork impression on Saturday Night Live, so recognizable and instantly funny while being completely over the top. It makes me wish Bjork was in the news more, just so I could see more of this impression. How I Write. I bought my house during the famous writer's strike of 2007. You, of course, remember the strike because it was over the hot-button and nationally polarizing issue of percentage of internet residuals accrued from online media in perpetuity. When I wasn't Norma Raying it up on the picket line, I spent the rest of my time decorating my house to look like something out of Architectural Digest, a kind of Santa Barbara meets artsy old lady vibe. I think I did only an adequate job, but I did avoid some LA house pitfalls. I'm proud to say I don't have a single vintage poster of some old-timey French product or a Buddha statue. But what I'm most proud of is my beautiful office. I built it and decorated it, and then I promptly never used it. It's important to me to have a museum-quality office, so when people or potential biographers come over, they think that's where I write. No, the truth is, when I write, I like to look like I'm recovering from tuberculosis. I sit in my bed, my laptop resting on a blanket or a Notre Dame sweatshirt on my lap. I got the sweatshirt when I was doing stand-up there in 2006. Where I bombed, by the way, those kids hated me and my long, matronly rants against low-rise jeans. I did a 3-college comedy tour with my Office co-star Craig Robinson, who is hilarious and a pro at performing in colleges. He plays the piano in his act, incorporating medleys of hit pop songs, and then does a rendition of an original song he wrote called Take Your Panties Off. I don't need to tell you that it's very funny and all the college kids wished he had partnered up with a different Office cast member. The blanket slash sweatshirt keeps the laptop from getting too hot and radiating my ovaries, which everyone knows makes your children come out with ADD. I almost always write alone in my house. I never have music on because I can't concentrate with Nelly Furtado remixes thumping through my house. And unfortunately, I only have dance music on my iPod, which is how I got to be such a great dancer. The main reason I enjoy working on a writing staff is because of the social nature of the job. To put it kindly, I am a very talkative social person. To put it less kindly, I'm a flibbertigibbet, which is what my frenemy Rainn Wilson calls me. It's always been incredibly challenging for me to put pen to page because writing, at its heart, is a solitary pursuit, designed to make people depressoids, drug addicts, misanthropes, and antisocial weirdos. See every successful writer except Judy Blume. I also have a nice office at work, but I use it primarily as a messy closet. The internet also makes it extraordinarily difficult for me to focus. One small break to look up exactly how many Kardashian children there are, and 4 hours later, I'm reading about the Donner Party and texting all my friends, "Did you guys know about the Donner Party and how messed up that was? Text me back so we can talk about it." I found my productive writing to screwing around ratio to be 1-7. So for every 8-hour day of writing, there's only one good productive hour of work being done. The other 7 hours are preparing for writing, pacing around the house, collapsing cardboard boxes for recycling, reading the DVD extras pamphlet from the BBC Pride and Prejudice, getting snacks lined up for writing, and YouTubing toddlers who learned the single ladies dance. I know, isn't that horrible? So basically, writing this piece took me the time between Thanksgiving and Christmas. Enjoy it accordingly. The day I stopped eating cupcakes. Very recently, I was out on script for The Office for a week. Out on script refers to when writers are sent off on their own to write a first draft of an episode of the show. It is an amazing time. Basically paid and sanctioned hooky. This means that instead of showering, dressing, and coming into work every day, I'm allowed to laze around in my house in a giant t-shirt and no pants, go shopping, and attend trendy cardio classes with my fun, unemployed friends. Obviously, this is the best time ever. This time when I was on script, I stopped by my favorite cupcake place, which I will call Sunshine Cupcakes. Sunshine Cupcakes, while a ridiculous name, is actually a restrained parody of cupcake bakery names. You have no idea. In Los Angeles, cupcake bakeries are as pervasive as Starbucks. They are the product of the city with an abundance of trophy wives. Because trophy wives are the financial engines of cutesy commerce that makes Los Angeles like no other American city. Toe jewelry, doorknob cozies, vegan dog food, you get it. If I am sounding mean, I should tell you how envious and admiring I am of these trophy wives. I'd marry a partner at William Morris Endeavor and start a cat pedicure parlor myself if I was so lucky. So yeah, on my 4th consecutive visit to Sunshine Cupcakes, I was paying for my cupcake when the female manager, who was wearing a cupcake apron, far-side glasses, and a streak of pink hair, the universal whimsical bakery lady uniform as far as I can tell, approached me. "Farside lady, you've come here a lot this week." Me, with my mouth full of generous sample, "Yeah, I love this place, man." "Farside lady, we know you're on Twitter." She leans in conspiratorially. "And if you're willing to tweet about loving Sunshine Cupcakes, this cupcake is free." I did not know that it was possible to be triple offended. First of all, manager woman, if you notice that a 31-year-old woman is coming to your cupcake bakery every day for a week, keep that information to yourself. I don't need to be reminded how poor my food choices are on a regular basis. Second, how cheap and or poor do you think I am? A cupcake costs like $2. You think I'm miserly enough to think, "Oh, goody, I can save those $2 for some other tiny purchase later today." And third, even if I were to buy into this weird bribey situation where I endorse your product, you think the cost of it would only be one measly cupcake? The implications of this offer were far worse than anything she meant to propose, obviously, but I hate her forever nonetheless. This is why I never eat cupcakes anymore, The connotations are too disturbing. Lucky for me, the mighty donut is making a comeback. No one better ruin donuts for me or I will be so pissed. Somewhere in Hollywood, someone is pitching this movie. A few years ago, I sat down for a meeting with some executives at a movie studio that I will call Thinkscope Vision Cloud. Thinkscope Vision Cloud had put out some of my favorite movies, and they wanted to hear some of my ideas. So I was naturally very excited. All television writers do is dream of one day writing movies. We long for the glitziness of the movie world. I'll put it this way. At the Oscars, the most famous person in the room is like Angelina Jolie. At the Emmys, the huge exciting celebrity is Kelsey Grammer. Look, I love Fraser Crane. He's awesome, but you get what I mean. It's snobby and grossly aspirational, but it's true. So I left work at the office early one afternoon with a see ya suckers attitude and headed to my destiny. The junior executive's office at Thinkscope Vision Cloud was nicer than any room in the 50-mile radius of the office studio. The stuffed chair I was sitting on was expensive leather and looked like the one a judge would sit on in his private chamber on a TV show. I was so nervous, the sweat from the back of my legs was making me stick to it. Oh yeah, I was wearing shorts to this meeting. What? For a television writer, shorts is like business casual. After I finished sharing one of my ideas for a low-budget romantic comedy, I was met with silence. One of the execs sheepishly looked at the other execs. Exec, yeah, we're really trying to focus in on movies about board games. People really seem to respond to those. For the rest of the meeting, we talked in earnest about if there was any potential in a movie called Yahtzee. I made some polite suggestions and left. I am always surprised by what movie studios think people will want to see. I'm even more surprised how correct they are a lot of the time. These following movies are my best guess as to what may soon be coming to a theater near you. Bananagrams 3D. Apples to Apples 4D. This is where audiences are pummeled with apples at the end of the movie. Crest White Strips. Sharks versus Volcanoes. King Tut versus King Kong. Streptococcus versus candidiasis, which is strep throat versus yeast infection. The Do-Over. The Switcheroo. Street Smart. Street Stupid, which is the Street Smart sequel. Bad Astronaut. The Untitled Liam Neeson You Took My Female Relative Project. The Untitled Jennifer Lopez Sonia Sotomayor Project. Darling, which is Peter Pan from the point of view of the Darling family's alcoholic dad. The Bear from those toilet paper ads movie 3D. Gross Catastrophe. Hate Fuck. Fat Slut. Sex Dude. Bad Dog Walker. You can see the poster already for this one, can't you? Heather Graham in booty shorts, pulled in 8 different directions by dogs on leashes and smiling a naughty grin. Grandpa Swap. Stepmom Finishing School. Human Quilt, which is a horror movie. I ain't your wife. You ain't my dad. As much as it may seem that I am mocking these movies, if any movie studio exec is listening to this and is interested in any of these ideas, I will gladly take a meeting about them. I have an almost completed outline for Crest White Strips. The best distraction in the world. Romance and guys. Someone explain one-night stands to me. I have never had a one-night stand. According to every women's magazine and television program ever made, this is super unforgivably lame, and it behooves me to go reclaim my groove on an all-girls party trip to an unincorporated island territory of the United States. Every romantic comedy I watch depicts our adorable heroine walking sheepishly back from a stranger's place in the morning with bedhead and with her eyeliner all sexy and smudged. She might not yet have found Mr. Right, this is only the beginning of the movie, but she's having fun looking. I just don't understand any of that at all. Here's why. In my mind, the sexiest thing in the world is the feeling that you're wanted. The slightly nervous asking of your phone number, the text messages asking you to dinner, the simple overture of wanting me can satisfy my ego for a good long time. The sexual situation that comes of it? Well, that's just less appealing to me. I don't mean to say I don't enjoy sex. I'm a properly functioning mammal and everything. I just think, like, who is this guy? Do Don't you need to know some more about a guy than an evening's worth of conversation at a bar to make sex appealing? Also, fear is a pretty big turnoff for me. I'm talking about safety here. I don't even mean sexual health safety like STDs. I mean good old-fashioned life and death safety. Here's what I can't wrap my brain around. I barely talk to strangers, a habit that I started as a child and that has served me well through my adulthood. So the idea of going to a stranger's house at night, or having that stranger over to my house, sounds insanely dangerous. These fears have made it so that when my female friends talk to me about one-night stands, I'm an incredibly irritating listener. Excited, sexually liberated friend. So then it was like 2 a.m. that night, and he knocked on my apartment door. I was in my robe and nothing else. Me. Wait, no underwear? My friend. No, I said nothing else. Me. I feel like you were wearing underwear. Is that how you are in, like, repose? My friend. Yes. Me. You really like not wearing underwear? Am I the only one who finds that totally uncomfortable? Don't you ever sometimes excrete? My friend. Stop it. Me. Okay. But let's remember to come back to this no underwear conversation later. My friend. So, he knocked at the door. Me, wait, sorry, I'm just realizing your doorman let him up without ever seeing him before. Doesn't that disturb you? That your doorman would just let any old person off the street up to your apartment? I would give my doorman a book of photos of accepted guests that he could reference, like a reference book. Friend, I'm doing fine with my doorman. Me, I would have established a different procedure. My friend, great, Mindy. Anyway, I showed him around the place. Me, the doorman? Oh, the guy. Yes, the guy. My friend. He was into the way I decorated it, really just taking it in. Me, he was casing the joint. My friend, no, he was not casing the joint, Mindy. He was being sexy and sweet and making cute little jokes about family photos. Then he asked if he could see my bedroom. Me, your bedroom so he could rape you. My friend, no, he wasn't trying to rape me. I was into it. So we go to my bedroom and he takes off his coat. Me, and he has a huge tranquilizer syringe, and he tried to drug you and then rape you and then murder you like in Copycat. Eventually, my constant interruptions make her so irritated, she stops telling me her sexy story. I guess nothing puts a damper on a one-night stand as much as your friend pointing out all the opportunities where you might have been killed. Don't get me wrong, I love hearing about it. I don't want to come off as prim or that I won't go see a rated R movie or something. In fact, I would feel sad if I didn't have my sexually liberated friend there to tell me fun, frank tales of desires fulfilled. I just don't think I could ever do it myself. So, this is what I'm like. If you come to my house, I need to know your first and last name. I need to have your phone number and a person whom we both know so you can't disappear forever in case you murder me. Ultimately, it comes down to this. How embarrassing would it be for me to be talking to a detective at a precinct after you tried to rape and murder me in my home, and not be able to tell him your name or any information about you because we were having a one-night stand? I've seen Law & Order SVU. I know how it works. Hooking up is confusing. The careful listener will note that my teens and early 20s were without significant sexual incident. Okay, even the not-so-careful listener will have noticed this. This happens when you have friends who are more likely to tell ghost stories in a living room with flashlights than recount tales of raunchy sex encounters. Because of this, I have fallen way behind in my terminology. I am especially tired of not knowing exactly what hooking up means. Some version of the following happens to me constantly. Psyched pal. Oh, hey, I hooked up with Nikki last night. Me. That's awesome. You liked her for a while. Nice job. We high five. There's a pause. Me. What does that mean? Hooking up. Did you have sex? Psyched pal. Mindy, you're disgusting. It's not that I'm some pervert looking for lurid details, this time anyway. It just, I have no idea what you're talking about. There have been times when friends have said they hooked up with someone, and all it means is that they had a highly anticipated kissing session. Other times, it's a full-on all-night sexathon. By the way, full-on all-night sexathon is also the name of my debut hip-hop album. Can't we have a universal understanding of the term once and for all? From now on, let's all agree that hooking up equals sex. Everything else is made out. And if you're older than 28, then just kissing someone doesn't count for crap and is not even worth mentioning. Unless you're Mormon, in which case you're going to hell. There, I think we're all on the same page. If Europe can figure out a way to do the euro, I feel confident we can all do this. I love Irish exits. I recently learned that an Irish exit is when you leave a party without telling anyone, and presumably it is because you are too drunk to form words. A French exit is when you leave a party early without saying goodbye to anyone or paying your share of the bill, and maybe you are also drunk. I may have found these on a kind of a xenophobic website. Makes me wonder about Jewish exits or black exits. Okay, thin ice. I know, too far. I think everyone should do Irish exits. Slipping away is basically all I do now at large parties. My version of an Irish exit has an air of deception to it, because it includes me asking loudly, where's the bathroom? And making theatrical looking around gestures like a lost foreign tourist. But then, instead of finding the bathroom, I sneakily grab my coat and leave. Other times I say, oh, I think I left my lights on my car. Or, oh my gosh, I think I left my car unlocked. Cars make great pretexts for Irish exits. People never doubt weird issues you have with your car because it's extremely boring to listen to. The reason I do Irish exits is not because I'm too busy and cool to be bothered with pleasantries. It's that when there is a gathering of more than 30 people, I don't want to waste your time with hellos and goodbyes. I think it's actually the more polite thing to do because I'm not coercing partygoers into some big farewell moment with me. Then other people feel like they have to stop what they're doing and hug me too. It's just a time-wasting dominoes. Look, there are times when I need hugs and attention. I don't want to waste that good, juicy human connection on when I'm sneaking out of a Memorial Day barbecue. Irish exits are supposed to be subtle, a way to leave without creating a disruption and, yes, on occasion, a way to perhaps escape notice for epic drunkenness. The only snag is you have to be comfortable lying directly to the faces of people you like. There has only been one time when someone actually busted me on it. It occurred at my friend Louise's birthday, on the roof of the Downtown Standard Hotel in LA when I was 27. I was having a crummy time because I was supposed to go with my friend Diana, but she couldn't make it last minute because she was going to Burning Man. I feel like I'm constantly being ditched for the Burning Man Festival. The Burning Man Festival is an annual festival that is an experiment in human expression. Only something reprehensible would be so vague. There are only a few things that I've never actually done that I can say I categorically hate. One is Burning Man. The others are skydiving, menage a trois, and when parents tell stories about their babies and do an impression of their babies' voices. I love hearing about your kid. Just use your normal voice. Anyway, Diana was going to be my wingwoman, but she was at Burning Man. I needed a wingwoman because I knew my ex-boyfriend was coming to the party with his new girlfriend, Chloe. A word about Chloe. Chloe was so young, or young-looking, she'd actually played the daughter of an actress 4 years older than me on a TV show. But the worst thing about Chloe is that she was sweet. Chloe approached me. Chloe, can I just say that you're my hero? I took the Long Island Railroad out to see Matt and Ben when I was in middle school. Oh, God, don't you dare, Chloe. Don't you dare make it impossible to hate you. Quit looking at me all earnest with those Bambi eyes. I know this game. I quickly said something weird like, bless you, child, and excused myself and then walked briskly away. I went over to Louisa, who was standing with my friend Pete, when I began to initiate my Irish exit. Me. Oh man, you know what? I think I left my glove compartment open when I parked here. I better go check on it. Pete.
Just say you're leaving. We know you're not coming back.
Pete read my mind. At that moment, I was actually thinking about which 24-hour taco stand and the drive back home would conceivably accept credit cards. A word about Pete. Pete is a very funny, direct, mildly pessimistic guy who's a great friend because it's like Larry David is your pal. He's also one of those guys whose plain-spokenness is charming when used on other people, but super irritating when used on you. Me. I'm not leaving. Just need to check my car and maybe use the bathroom. Just drinking so much water these days. Health. Haha. I mimed drinking a long gulp of water to sell the point. Pete.
Why must you always tell us why you're going to the bathroom?
Pete had a point. No one has ever been curious about what people do when they say they have to go to the bathroom. It was a sure sign of guilt. Giving too much information about my cover story was such an amateur move. Ugh, That stupid Chloe threw me off with her hot youngness and surprising sweetness. Why not just be a total bitch to me like I would have been if I had been the hot and young one? Damn it, Chloe! Then I got an idea. Me. So, am I trying to sneak out? Or am I trying to use the bathroom, Pete? Get your idea of my motivation straight before you accuse me of something. I looked around to see if anyone else had noticed my rainmaker level, closing arguments level rebuttal. Nope. Pete.
You're obviously leaving.
Me. Well, would someone who is sneaking out leave their coat here? I slowly took off my jacket and with a flourish, hurled it on a sofa. I looked at Pete triumphantly as I marched out of the room. I was still marching triumphantly as I walked down the hall, past the women's bathroom, into the elevator, across the lobby of the standard to the street, where I got into my car and drove off. The jacket was from Forever 21. Sorry, Pete. You don't know the freedom of a $17 coat when caught at a party with an ex-boyfriend and his new hot girlfriend. And that, my friends, is how to execute an Irish exit. Thank you, Forever 21. Guys need to do almost nothing to be great. Forgive me, but being a guy is so easy. A little Kiehl's, a little Bumble and Bumble, a peacoat and Chuck Taylors, and you're hot. Here's my incredibly presumptuous guide to being an awesome guy inside and out. Mostly out, for who am I to instruct you on your inner improvement? Let me just say here that if you're some kind of iconoclastic dude who goes by the beat of your own drum, you will find this insufferable. I totally get this. But why are you even listening to this book at all? Shouldn't you be hiking the Appalachian Trail or something? Number one. Buy a well-fitting peacoat from J. Crew. Or wait until Christmas sales are raging and buy a designer one like John Varvatos or something. Black looks good on everyone and matches everything. But charcoal gray is good too. You can always look like a put-together Obama speech writer with a classy peacoat. Oh, and get it cleaned once a year. Sounds prissy, but a good cleaning can return a peacoat to its true black luster and make you look as snappy as you did the first day you wore it. Number two, have a signature drink like James Bond. I know it sounds silly, but I'm always so impressed if a guy has a cool go-to drink. Obviously, if it has a ton of fancy ingredients like pureed berries or whatever, you can look a little bit like a high-maintenance weirdo, so don't do that. If you like scotch, have a favorite brand. It makes you look all self-actualized and grown up. You don't have to say your drink order with the theatrical panache of James Bond. That's for close-ups. Number three. Own several pairs of dark wash straight leg jeans. Don't get boot cut, don't get skinny, just a nice pair of Levi's without any embellishments on the pockets. No embellishments anywhere, at all, nothing, oh my God. Number four, wait until all the women have gotten on or off an elevator before you get on or off. Look, I'm not some chivalry nut or anything, but this small act of politeness is very visual and memorable. Number five, when you think a girl looks pretty, say it, but don't reference the thing that might reveal you are aware of the backstage process. E.g., say, you look gorgeous tonight, not, I like how you did your makeup tonight. Also, a compliment means less if you compliment the thing and not the way the girl is carrying it off. So say, you look so sexy in those boots, rather than, those boots are really cool. I didn't make the boots. I don't care if you like the boots design. We are magic to you. You have no idea how we got to look as good as we do. Number six. Avoid asking if someone needs help in a kitchen or at a party, just start helping. Same goes with dishes. Actually, if you don't want to help, you should ask them if they need help. No self-respecting host or hostess will say yes to that question. Number seven, have one great cologne that's not from the drugstore. Just one. Wear very little of it all of the time. I cannot tell you how sexy it is to be enveloped in a hug by a man whose smell you remember. Then, anytime I smell the cologne, I think of you. Way to invade my psyche, guy. Shivers down spine central. Number eight. Your girlfriend's sibling or parents might be totally nuts, but always defend them. Always. All a girl wants to do is get along with her family. And if you are on the side of making it easy, you will be loved eternally. It might be easier to condemn them, especially if she's doing that already. But remarkably, even if they are murderers, she will always find the good in them. Especially if you start trashing them. Be the guy who says, hey, let's go visit your brother in prison on prison visiting day. Most likely, she'll never make you actually do it, and she will always remember you offered. Number nine. Kiehl's for your skin, Bumble and Bumble for your hair, maybe a comb. That is all you need. And when girls look in your medicine cabinet, which they will obviously do within the first 5 minutes of coming to your place, you'll look all classily self-restrained because you'll only have 2 beauty products. You're basically a cowboy. Number 10. I really think guys only need 2 pairs of shoes. A nice pair of black shoes and a pair of Chuck Taylors. The key, of course, is that you need to replace your Chuck Taylors every single year. You cannot be lax about this. Those shoes start to stink like hell. They cost $40. You can afford a new pair every year. And if you can't, why can't you? You have much bigger problems. Stop reading this and deal with them. Number 11. Bring wine or chocolate to everything. People love when guys do that. Not just because of the gift, but because it is endearing to imagine you standing in line at Trader Joe's before the party. Number 12. Get a little jealous now and again, even if you're not strictly a jealous guy. Too much and it's frightening. But a possessive hand on her back at a party when your girlfriend looks super hot is awesome. Non-traumatic things that have made me cry. I feel like we know each other pretty well by now. You've heard about African kids bullying me, Broadway plays rejecting me, and my boss throwing me out of my place of employment. When I've cried about these things, the pain was real. So I guess I should actually feel grateful for all the times I cried from something that did not scar me emotionally. Isn't that what makes us wiser or more interesting or something? Nietzsche did a whole thing about this. Anyway, in addition to crying at typical girl crybait, like The Notebook, I also have been moved to tears by some other stuff, which I've listed in no particular order. The Promise of Evan Lieberman. Just before Christmas time, when I was 26, I met a really cool guy. I'll call him Evan. He was in finance, and he had been the college roommate of my friend Jeff, who worked on a sitcom I loved. Evan was smart, financially stable, and he loved comedy, even though he wasn't in comedy. We had roughly the same job description, which was that we both worked long hours at jobs we loved. Most notably, Evan was cheerful. This sounds odd, but cheerful is very hard to find in Los Angeles. I think sometimes people think cheerful is a synonym for dumb, so no one is ever cheerful. At that time, I remember thinking, I just want to meet a guy who has not been, at one point in his life, diagnosed with clinical depression. That is my only criterion. Oh, and that he wouldn't make me convert religions if things got serious. One thing you should know about me, I absolutely refuse to stop being a culturally Hindu, deeply superstitious Christmas tree haver. Evan was very exciting. For our first date, he took me to a really cool Korean barbecue place in Koreatown that he clearly had researched and driven by beforehand. That kind of apparent effort slays me. Over dinner, Evan told lots of slightly embarrassing and funny stories about himself. He loved The Office and had seen exactly half the episodes, which was the perfect amount to me for some reason. He was funny in a natural way. Plus, he was super cute, in a handsomest guy in the AP calculus class kind of way, if that makes sense. Do you guys have any real idea how much time girls spend getting ready for a promising date? For my second date with Evan, I spent the afternoon getting my eyebrows waxed and my nails done, and spent a fortune at Fred Siegel on a new skirt, and even more time making the salespeople all weigh in. I honestly don't understand how people go on dates on weeknights. Don't they all want that fun time before to get ready? I had kept all my best friends updated about my upcoming date in a long and exhaustively detailed email chain with the subject heading, "Holy shit, you guys, is Evan Lieberman the answer?" I really enjoy all these rituals. It's part of the fun of having a good date to look forward to, but it takes a lot of time and effort. At 6:30 that night, I was standing in my bathroom with my hair in curlers. It's true, pink curlers, like in a Doris Day movie, when Evan texted to cancel dinner because he wasn't feeling well. No details of a sickness, no apologetic eagerness to set a new date, nothing. Just a vague and short text that ended with a frowny face emoticon. It was less than an hour before he was supposed to pick me up. I started crying almost immediately. A remarkable thing about me is the time that elapses between a sad thought and a flood of tears is only 3 or 4 seconds. I felt so foolish, having spent so much time and money getting ready. Besides the pain of rejection, he was also robbing me of a fun evening, getting taken out, a goodnight kiss, and updating my, "Holy shit, you guys, is Evan Lieberman the answer?" correspondence, with an exuberant reply all. It sounds trite, and it is, but it is so hard to meet anyone I would even consider spending time alone with. So it was a painful blow that it was over as quickly as it had begun. I sent a new email to my friends by only changing the subject heading to, "He bailed via text. Is it cool to be a spinster screenwriter who lives in your attic?" My friends all called immediately and texted within minutes with the appropriate "fuck that guy" messages. As for Evan, I texted back a breezy, "no worries, feel better" text to save face. Evan thanked me for being cool about it, and I never heard from him again. Ballet guys who are my dad's age. I can't even deal with this. When I see a man who is around my father's age running down the street to get a car, it breaks my heart. The album Graceland. In 2004, when I started working at the office and had no friends, I would listen to Graceland and just weep. On the way to work, on the way home, and not just the more ballady songs about loss like Graceland, I even cried to You Can Call Me Al. The secret I learned is that albums that remind me of my childhood happiness make me incredibly sad now. I only have perfect memories of singing along to Graceland with my parents on long car rides to Virginia Beach to visit my parents' friends. It's sort of my go-to stock image of my childhood, actually. I think it has something to do with knowing that I'll never be able to go back to that time, and that makes me cry every time I listen to it. Depressing Zeitgeisty magazine articles about relationships. Every couple months or so, some boundary-breaking article comes out in a nationally published magazine. The article makes a big thesis statement about relationships, like, say, how women don't need men anymore, or how if you're a woman over 35, you should just settle with whatever guy is halfway nice to you, or how monogamy is not feasible or plausible or enjoyable for any human, and we should all be swingers. Or a study is released that says you don't have to love your kids anymore or something. They're the kind of articles that are emailed everywhere, and I get them forwarded to me about 8 times. I'll read one of these articles, and immediately after, I'm so swept up in it that I can't help but think, yes, yes, that is 100% right. Finally, someone has confirmed that little voice in the back of my mind that has always not loved my kids. Or, I'm so happy I'm this much closer to my swinging lifestyle I've always been secretly craving. I'm normal, and now it's a national discussion and others agree, and I can feel normal now. But then, a week later, I'm thinking, I hate this. I feel awful. This wretched little magazine article has helped convince more open-minded liberal arts graduates that the nuclear family doesn't exist without some hideous twist, like the dad is allowed to go to an S&M dungeon once a week or something. It makes me cry, because it means that fewer and fewer people are believing it's cool to want what I want, which is to be married and have kids and love each other in a monogamous, long-lasting relationship. Mark Darcy. All women love Colin Firth. Mr. Darcy, Mark Darcy, George the Sixth. At this point, he could play the Craigslist killer, and people would be like, oh my god, the Craigslist killer has the most boyish smile. I love Colin Firth and everything, even as the obsessed, miffed, tortured, non-Ralph Fiennes husband in The English Patient. But the role that makes me cry is Mark Darcy from Bridget Jones' Diary. When we first meet Mark, he's kind of a, well, dick. He's arrogant and judgmental, and seems to take himself so seriously, but he is secretly wonderful, and not so secretly gorgeous. There is a part in the movie, I've seen it 6 or 7 times, and I swear to God, every time I see it coming, I start tearing up in anticipation, when we first see that Mark Darcy is not a bad guy. In fact, we see that he is the best guy ever. Do you guys remember the scene when Bridget is sneaking out of the horrible couple's dinner, having humiliated herself in front of all of her smug marrieds? And when she's at the door, Mark stops her and says, I like you very much, just as you are. It's ridiculous that I love this so much. It's so simple. It's not a witty, perfectly phrased, Ephrani declaration by our charming neurotic hero. It's so plain. But the idea is the most beautiful thing in the world. So, obviously, it makes me cry. A Charlie Brown Christmas soundtrack album. If I ever get cast in some changeling-type movie where I need to cry instantly because my child was murdered, I will make sure to have Vince Guaraldi's A Charlie Brown Christmas album ready to go in my trailer. The children's voices and connections to the Peanuts from my childhood are just the beginning. I always identified with Peppermint Patty, in case you were wondering, the loud, opinionated man-girl who chased around her crush without even fully knowing she liked him. The music is gorgeous, but even the upbeat arrangements are tinged with something sad, like Joni Mitchell's Blue. Joni Mitchell's Blue. I know every single word to this album, but you would never know that because I blubber through the entire thing. Also, I find it extremely impossible not to cry when I hear Stevie Nicks' Landslide, especially the lyric, I've been afraid of changing because I've built my life around you. I think a good test to see if a human is actually a robot slash android slash Cylon is to have them listen to this song lyric and study their reaction. If they don't cry, you should stab them through the heart. You will find a fuse box. If my mom cries. It makes absolutely no difference what it is about, but if my mother is crying, I will start to cry. I think it mostly has to do with the fact that my mom never cries. She is so cool. Me, on the other hand, I cry like 5 times a week. My mom and I went to go see The Help, and during the movie, I noticed her starting to tear up. It was such a rare sight, I started to tear up as well. Soon, we were both weeping so hard, it was as though we had been black maids in Jim Crow-era Mississippi, and the movie had hit too close to home. People were rooted out. Jewish guys. First, a disclaimer. I know many racist people say, but some of my best friends are black, before they go off on a long racist rant. This does not count as an excuse for racism anymore. I get it. However, I think I have a different circumstance. All of my best friends are Jewish. Doesn't that let me say whatever I want? I certainly hope so, because I have a lot to say. Don't be such hypochondriacs. What? I have a cold. Don't get a look of terror on your face. The worst thing that could happen is that you get a cold too. You don't have to theatrically Purell 1,000 times a day and look all panicky every time I come into the room. Also, in the unlikely event that you do get sick, you do not have to give everyone a play-by-play, as though none of us has ever been sick before, or as though there was some suspense in the story of your cold with twists and turns. I woke up this morning feeling pretty good, only to take a terrible turn for the worse after lunch. I know this story. You get better. It works out. But what if it's more than a cold? It's not. It's just a cold. Hiring someone to hang up a picture on your wall. Is it as bad as hiring a guy to have sex with your wife? No, it's not as bad as that, but you get my point. I'm sorry I said that. Fine. Hire a guy to hang a picture on your wall. Fine, fine, fine. I don't know how to get it exactly straight either. Thanks for being so into Indian food. In college, all the non-Jewish guys would treat Indian food as though it were an exotic anomaly to be greeted with oohs and ahs. I like that when we go to an Indian restaurant, you don't look over the menu pleadingly and ask if I will just order for both of us. Larry David. I get mad about your perceived special connection with him. Like when you give that knowing chuckle and say, oh, Larry, like he's some incorrigible friend of your dad's from Temple. We both know him from watching him on a show, which we watched together at the same time. Israel. Okay. Israel is interesting, but every time we talk about it, it has to be like for 2 hours and then you start screaming. I want to talk about it, but it can't be for 2 hours. I have a mom, too. Hey, look, I know you talk to your mom twice a day on the phone, and I talk to my mom only once a day. That doesn't mean your mom beats my mom. Also, I know your mom is an amazing cook. I feel like you think my mom cooked us hamburger helper growing up. When you talk to me about your mom and how great she is, I listen respectfully and say, wow, she really does sound great. But when I talk about my mom, you kind of glaze over like I'm some delusional kid talking about how I'm going to be president someday. You can't even muster the slightest bit of acknowledgement that anyone else's mom could come close to being as funny, artsy, nurturing, and irreverent as your mom. Except Ezekiel, Rahm, and Ari Emanuel's mom. We both agree. She's incredible. She can do whatever she wants. Natalie Portman. I know a small part of you thinks you could have ended up with Natalie Portman if you had played things a little differently. That's nice. You can have that. That's not hurting anybody. Men and boys. Sometimes I bring a script I'm working on to a restaurant and sit near people and eavesdrop on them. I could rationalize it. Oh, this is good anthropological research for characters I'm writing. But it's basically just nosiness. I especially like eavesdropping on women my age. Besides it being titillating, it also helps me gauge where I am in comparison. Am I normal? Am I doing the correct trendy cardio exercises? Am I reading the right books? Is gluten still lame? Is soap cool again, or is body wash still the way to go? It was from eavesdropping that I learned that you could buy fresh peanut butter from Whole Foods from a machine that grinds it right in front of you. So yeah, I highly recommend a little nosiness once in a while. So once, at BLD, a restaurant where I was writing, I saw two attractive 30-ish women talking over brunch. They had finished eating and were getting seconds on coffee, so I knew it was going to be good. I heard the following, girl one. Pretty Jewish girl, Lululemon yoga pants, great body. Jeremy just finished his creative writing program at Columbia, but now he wants to maybe apply to law school. Girl number two, tiny Asian girl, sheet of black hair, strangely huge breasts for an Asian girl. Oh God, Lululemon, what? 32D, how many grad schools is he going to go to? Lululemon, I know, but it's not his fault. No publishers are buying short stories from unfamous people. Basically, you have to be Paris Hilton to sell books these days. 32D. For the past 10 years that Jeremy has been out of college doing entry-level job after entry-level job in grad school, you've had a job that has turned into a career. Lululemon. Yeah, so? 32D. Jeremy's a boy. You need a man. Lululemon did not take this well, as I anticipated. I felt bad for Lulu, because I've been Lulu. It's really hard when you realize the guy you've been dating is basically a high schooler at heart. It makes you feel like Mary Kay Letourneau. It's the worst. Until I was 30, I only dated boys, as far as I can tell. I'll tell you why. Men scared the shit out of me. Men make concrete plans. Men know what they want. Men own alarm clocks. Men tip generously. Men sleep on a mattress that isn't on the floor. Men buy new shampoo instead of adding water to a nearly empty bottle of shampoo. Men go to the dentist. Men make reservations. Men go in for a kiss without giving you some long preamble about how they're thinking of kissing you. Men wear clothes that have never been worn by anyone else before. Okay, maybe men aren't exactly like this. This is what I've cobbled together from the handful of men I know or know of, ranging from Heathcliff Huxtable to Theodore Roosevelt to my dad. Men know what they want, and they don't let you in on their inner monologue, and that is scary. Because what I was used to was boys. Boys are adorable. Boys trail off their sentences in an appealing way. Boys bring a knapsack to work. Boys get haircuts from their roommate, who totally know how to cut hair. Boys can pack up their whole life in a duffel bag and move to Brooklyn for a gig if they need to. Boys have gigs. Boys are broke. And when they do have money, they spend it on a trip to Colorado to see a music festival. Boys don't know how to adjust their conversation when they're talking to their friends or to your parents. They put parents on the same level as their peers and roll their eyes when your dad makes a terrible pun. Boys let your parents pay for dinner when you all go out. It's assumed. Boys are wonderful in a lot of ways. They make amazing, memorable homemade gifts. They're impulsive. Boys can talk for hours with you at a diner at 3 in the morning because they don't have regular work hours. But they suck to date when you turn 30. I'm 32, and I fully feel like an adult. Sure, sometimes I miss wearing Hello Kitty jewelry or ironic t-shirts from Urban Outfitters. Who doesn't? I don't because I think it would seem kind of pitiful. But a guy at 32, he can act and dress like a grown man or a 13-year-old boy, and both are totally acceptable. Not necessarily to me, but to most people. I can't tell you how many 30- and 40-year-old guys wear Velcro shoes in Los Angeles. It's an epidemic. That's what I've noticed about being 32. It is a lot of women and a lot of boys our age. That's why I started getting interested in men. When I was 25, I went on exactly 4 dates with a much older guy whom I'll call Peter Parker. I'm calling him Peter Parker because the actual guy's name was also alliterative and because, well, it's my book and I'll name a guy I dated after Spider-Man's alter ego if I want to. Peter Parker was a comedy writer who was a smidgen more accomplished than me, but who talked about everything with a tone of, you've got a lot to learn, kid. He had been a writer on a pretty popular sitcom. He gave me lots of unsolicited advice about how to get a job if The Office ever got canceled. After a while, it became clear that he thought The Office would get canceled, and on our 4th and last date, it was clear that he thought The Office should get canceled. Why am I bringing up Peter Parker? Well, besides moonlighting as Spider-Man, Peter was the first man I dated. An insufferable, arrogant man, but a legit man. Peter owned a house. It wasn't ritzy or anything, just a little, Spanish, ranch-style house in Hollywood. But he was the first guy I'd dated who'd really moved into his place and made it a home. The walls were painted. There was art in frames. He had installed a flat-screen TV and speakers. There was just so much screwed into the walls. Everywhere I looked, I saw another instance of an action that, if the house were rented, he would have lost his deposit. I marveled at the brazenness of it. Peter's house reminded me more of my house growing up than a college dorm room, and I had never seen that before. Look, I'm not an idiot. I realize plenty of boys own homes. That's like the whole point of the Playboy Mansion. Owning a house obviously wasn't enough to make me want to keep dating Peter. Like I said, he was kind of a condescending dick. But I observed in Peter a quality I found really appealing, and I knew I wanted in the next guy I dated seriously, a guy who wasn't afraid of commitment. At this point, you might want to smack me and say, "Are you seriously another grown woman talking about how she wants a man who isn't afraid of commitment? Is this a book or a blog called Ice Cream Castles in the Air, One Single Gal Hopes for Prince Charming?" We've all heard this before. But let me explain. I'm not talking about commitment to romantic relationships. I'm talking about commitment to things. Houses, jobs, neighborhoods. Having a job that requires a contract. Paying a mortgage. I think when men hear that women want a commitment, they think it means commitment to a romantic relationship, but that's not it. It's a commitment to not floating around anymore. I want a guy who is entrenched in his own life. Entrenched is awesome. So, I'm into men now. Even though they can be frightening. I want a schedule-keeping, waking-up-early, wallet-carrying, non-Velcro shoe-wearing man. I don't care if he has more traditionally men problems, like having to take prescription drugs for cholesterol or hair loss. I can handle it. I'm a grown-up, too. In defense of chest hair. As a 13-year-old, my big celebrity crush was Pierce Brosnan. Yeah, I know. Pierce Brosnan is such an uncreative crush that it sounds like the panicked choice of a closeted lesbian teenager. But Pierce was my guy. I was 13 and watching Mrs. Doubtfire in the theater with all my friends. There was a scene in which Pierce Brosnan gets out of a pool, Cheryl Teague style. He is manly and glistening, and I remember this one point very clearly. He had a thick swatch of chest hair. It was a minor sexual awakening during Mrs. Doubtfire. Not a movie often cited for its idealized depiction of traditional masculinity. I have always liked a man with chest hair. I have only fond memories of my dad's chest hair as a kid, peeking out of a really cool button-up shirt he wore with a map of the world on it. I think chest hair looks distinguished. It's like, cool, my dad's a man. So, I really don't understand why men shave or wax their chests. I find it so unnecessary. I mean, I sort of get it if you're like a professional swimmer, because each hair follicle adds a second to your time or something, but it's every single male actor in Hollywood. When I turn on an hour-long drama, and all I see are these 40-year-old men with hairless chests, I feel slightly nauseated. Why? For the same reason one might feel nauseated by a woman with too many cosmetic injectables in her face. It just shows so much icky effort to conform to some arbitrary beauty standard. And the standard in this instance is particularly insane. You want to strip your body of something that is so coolly and distinctly male? Yuck! When I see a perfectly hairless, tanned guy on screen, I am forced to recall the Chihuahua. Or, I think of the process by which the man got rid of his chest hair. How much did it cost to get waxed? Will it grow out with prickly stubble? And frankly, guys, you should be suspect of these gals who are like va-va-va-voom over your smooth, hair-free chest. She must either want you to look like a Chippendale, who are all gay anyway, as everyone knows, or a little boy. Look, I know the male equivalent of my opinion is that creepy guy who declares that he loves women to be au naturel, with a gross glint in his eye. But I'd rather be a female version of that than not say this at all. Besides, I've already revealed myself as a bit of a creep in several sections in this book. Please leave your chest hair alone. Married people need to step it up. Pretty much the only thing I remember from my Shakespeare course in college is that one can identify a comedy as opposed to a tragedy because it ends in a wedding. I also remember that weird play, The Winter's Tale, where a woman poses as a statue for years or something. I remember thinking, what am I reading? This is ridiculous. That's also how, I've noticed, many romantic comedies end. I think the actual reason Shakespeare ended them there is because he thought the journey leading up to marriage was more fun to watch than the one that begins after the vows were said. Growing up, I would say about 25% of the kids I knew had divorced parents. It wasn't out of the ordinary at all. And in fact, it was kind of glamorous. You never knew which parent's house you were going to have a sleepover at. And you hoped it was the dad's. The dad's house always had cable TV or a pool. And he ordered out for dinner instead of cooking. As an adult, I've met an ocean of divorced people. I might even know more divorced people than married people because I live in godless Los Angeles.